Let's begin by reading Genesis 3, verse 6, which we began looking at last week. Who has that?
I think that's the short one you gave me, right?
Yeah. So can we handle it?
We went through prayer, so.
Okay.
All right. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to her eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate.
Oh, yeah, and then there's that. And he ate. Three little words. Let's step back from the minute details of the passage before us to consider for a moment its simplicity. Though Yahweh God knows his future plans for humanity, the two first humans are ignorant of all that. As yet, there is no Mosaic law, no Ten Commandments, no details about Levitical regulations for sacrifice and atonement. There is no Messiah to be the once and final sacrifice for sin, but who will also bring his own commandments for righteous behavior. John 14. This scene is pre-law and pre-gospel. There is no written word of God to be dissected and argued by man. It'd be nice to be back to those days. Here we have just two solitary human beings given verbal instruction by their maker. It's a very simple and direct relationship. Without the clutter of scholarship and interpretation, the first man is told by the one who has just created him, along with everything else he sees around him, that if he eats from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he will surely die. Period. Subsequently, the woman, unaware that he speaks for Satan, is told by just another of the created creatures that if she eats from the tree, she surely will not die. Who to believe? We can debate what the woman knew of Yahweh's command, and we have in this room. But we cannot do the same for the man. He had full knowledge of what the Creator had said. So the man made a clear, informed choice to disobey the God of his creation. His father, as it were, and obey the created serpent. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. There were not yet any moral grays in the world, only blacks and whites. The man and woman chose black. When we digest this fateful scene, along with others such as the fall of Satan himself, we can only recognize the evidence that all created beings, humans, angels, beasts of the field, et al., do indeed have instilled in them from their moment of creation, hekousios is the Greek word, free will, found only in Philemon verse 14. They are God-created good. Our text says very good. Genesis 1:31. Yet with the inherent ability to make wrong, even evil decisions. Before we move on to verse 7, I would like to draw our attention to two small words near the end of verse 6. With her. My guess is that most of us have typically pictured the scene roughly this way. The woman is one day out wandering around in the garden. by herself and comes across a serpent who opens a dialogue with her. Note that she's not surprised by this. They converse for a while, and the result is that Eve takes fruit from the tree and bites into it. Just about then, the man happens by, and the woman offers some of the fruit to him, which he eats. Now, am I correct? Is that mostly the generally the way we have pictured it? Disguised in a salad?
Clearly. She said it was healthy, though, so he ate.
Okay.
I was always told I should do what my wife tells me to do. Maybe that's not the way it
is. We're not going to go there. It's possible that most of us, after the Apostle Paul, have understood that the man bears the guilt for this sin because he was the woman's corporate head. Let's look at that. Romans chapter 5. Romans 5. Let's read verses 12 to 14. Our text says simply, she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. Except for the ESV and NIVs, which they add, who was with her? Which hints, admittedly, just hints at a different arrangement of the scene. Interestingly, here's what Matthew Henry writes about this. She gave also to her husband with her. It is probable that he was not with her when she was tempted. Parentheses, surely if he had, he would have interposed to prevent the sin. Close parentheses. Matthew Henry continues, but came to her when she had eaten and was prevailed upon by her to eat likewise. My response to that is, what evidence do we have that Henry's supposition might be true? None whatsoever. In fact, we have considerable evidence to the contrary. If the first man being there would have prevented the sin, he surely would have refused the offer of the fruit from his mate. Right? What does Henry base that on? That he would have interposed to prevent the sin? I don't think so. There's nothing in the text to preclude the man being there all along with her, as the ESV and NIVs suggest. Where's Renee when I give a shout out to the NIVs? And if so, this would make a rather powerful statement about Adam. I have long marveled at the humility, faith, and trust in God exhibited by another husband, Joseph, the betrothed of Mary. What a guy. What a guy. What a beautiful example for every husband. Willingly giving of himself to protect his wife. He put his own life on the line for his. She wasn't even officially, they were just betrothed. They were in the culture of the time, in the Hebrew culture, they were locked together, but they were not yet sharing a bed. But if Adam was with the first woman all along during the temptation of the serpent, he exhibited just the opposite. If he was there all along, why didn't he stop her? If he only came in at the end of the scene, why did he take the fruit? Why didn't he speak up for the law of his Lord and Maker? He knew the command. We don't have to wonder about him. He was told the command. Why didn't he protect his wife from suffering the consequences of such a betrayal? And why did he silently go along with it? What a wimp. Something Paul wrote to Timothy leads some to think that Adam was held to account solely because he was the woman's corporate head. It's kind of the way I've thought of it most of the time. That it was all the woman's fault. He just took the rap because he was the corporate head. Turn, please, to 1 Timothy. The other way. Where's Timothy? I can never find Timothy. Hang on. 1 Timothy, I'm getting there. You got to understand the rhythm of this class. First, the teacher has to find 1 Timothy. Let's see, it's before Hebrews, isn't it? I've taught most of these books and I can never find them. 1 Timothy, okay. New Bible. It's mostly Old Testament. Funny about that. 1 Timothy 2, verses 12 to 14.
But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression.
Now that's an interesting statement. I confess, I've always read that a certain way, but now I'm reading it a different way. Verse 14 says only that, quote, it was not Adam who was deceived, end quote. That not only does not mean he was blameless, as some interpret it, it suggests a deeper level of culpability in him. He wasn't deceived. When he took a bite from the fruit, he knew exactly what he was doing. The woman may have ignorantly bought into the serpent's lie, but Adam's act was one of naked rebellion against Yahweh God. He should have been held to account. He knew better. Now, I freely confess that my suggestions, I would not even call them positions, regarding how long Adam accompanied Eve at the tree and the interpretation of 1 Timothy 2:14 are not necessarily mainstream. Most commentators posit different interpretations. However, I'm convinced that the text allows for my interpretations. Let's read our next verse. Yeah, I should have paused anyway. Go ahead.
No, I just
what do you got?
On 6 there, you know, it's, if you read that, you know, we were saying, well, you know, Adam knew, and he did, obviously. The Bible's pretty clear, but, you know, the woman saw that the tree was good for food and it was a delight to the eyes. Well, if he was right there, he's maybe thinking, yeah, that does look good, and it is delightful to the eyes.
Yeah,
he took it.
Could be. Something made him eat the fruit.
Yeah. Anyway, verse 7.
The difference is that he had had the explicit command
Absolutely.
From God, we know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He didn't see anything happen to her, so. Because she ate it first.
Many say that. Many, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Why not? Hey.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting in 3
3:17 is that God's indictment specifically to Adam is twofold. One, because you have heeded the voice of your wife, and then two, because you have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you. Mm-hmm. So there's a twofold, like, because of these two things. One, so I haven't studied enough to know, like, so one is her, you've heeded the voice of your wife.
Like she heeded the voice of the serpent, he heeded the voice of her.
And then number two,
I told you not to do it.
You ate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so there's like a twofold indictment there.
Two sins. So he abdicated his position.
Yeah.
Wrongfully. That's one.
And had to pay for it. Yeah.
Which he knew better.
Yeah.
Whereas the woman, he doesn't tell her, like when he says what her punishment is, he doesn't tell her, like, because you did, in verse 16, he just says, and to the woman, he said that word, but he puts this more culpability, so to speak, maybe, on the man and say, okay, because of this. But anyway, I just thought that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yahweh covers both reasons against him. Yeah.
Really makes the sermon this morning all the more important. Be watchful, stand firm in the faith.
Be a man.
Like man, be strong.
Yeah. I think we're ready for verse 7 now.
I'm sure we've covered it all, so it's time.
Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. That again, I've thought about that. Isn't that just interesting? If you didn't know anything else, it's like, what a revelation. All of a sudden, they're like, huh.
Huh. Yeah.
That you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, we've been this way for who knows how long they were on the earth. All of a sudden, never having given it any thought, now we're naked.
Somehow their eyes were open.
Oddly enough, we're going to get into that. Leupold considers this one of the saddest anticlimaxes of history. Then he quotes another commentator, I think you pronounce his name Prox, who writes, they eat, they expect marvelous results, they wait, and there grows on them the sense of shame. Based on the serpent's lies, they expect something wondrous to happen. They eat, they expect marvelous results, they wait, and there grows on them the sense of shame. Now, note the contrast between verses 1 to 6 with verse 7. The first six verses, and especially verse 6 itself, focus on the woman exclusively until the very end of verse 6. The verse 6 includes, then the woman. So she took from its fruit, she gave also to her husband. But then in verse 7, suddenly, but naturally, since both have now sinned, they are united in the result of their mutual sin. In their actions following and in their mutual shame. Now, I must admit that the contrast between verses 1 to 6 with its focus on the woman and verse 7 can easily lead one to conclude that the man wasn't even there. That could make sense. How are we to define this sudden sense of shame? Where does it come from? Where stems the impetus for their need to cover themselves and to specifically cover their sexual organs? We need to be careful with this. Too many commentators make assumptions that the text does not seem to support. Too many come at this with our contemporary standards and mindsets. We need to be careful. Later on, I'm going to use an illustration, but I'm not suggesting that our interpretation is based on that. It's just kind of a happenstance. The text says, and the eyes of both of them were opened. The Hebrew for eyes is ein, curiously enough. It is the word for the physical eye. It's used in more metaphorical ways as well. But I think we can safely take this to mean something more expansive than simply that the man and woman's eyesight was improved. Remember what the serpent told the woman in verse 5. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Listen to what Alexander McLaren writes to this. Now, if you ever stumble across Alexander McLaren, he was a Scottish Baptist minister. He lived from 1826 to 1910. What I have on my bookshelf is not his commentary, but his sermons. It's a collection of his sermons. Here's what he writes. The promise of knowing good and evil was indeed kept, but instead of its making the sinners like gods, it showed them that they were like beasts and brought the first sense of shame. To know evil was, no doubt, a forward step intellectually, but to know it by experience and as part of themselves necessarily changed their ignorant innocence into bitter knowledge. And conscience awoke to rebuke them. The first thing that their opened eyes saw was themselves, and the immediate result of the sight was the first blush of shame. Before they had walked in innocent unconsciousness, like angels or infants. Now they had knowledge of good and evil because their sin had made evil a part of themselves, and the knowledge was bitter. That's good. What the serpent held out as a carrot was intellectual enlightenment. What the man and woman got instead was an injection of moral degeneracy. Now they knew that they had once been innocent, good, but were now evil. A poor bargain. And they knew that they were naked. So again, we have to ask, what has just happened here? What is the nature of this change in the first man and woman? We must answer this question, for Adam and Eve were created with a nature utterly different from our own, from the nature with which we are born. Citing passages such as Psalm 104, 1-2, let me read that. Bless Yahweh, O my soul. O Yahweh, my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, wrapping yourself with light as with a cloak, stretching out the heavens like a tent curtain. Now, based on that and some other passages, some, such as Donald Barnhouse, who I'm beginning to lose faith in. When we were in our wilderness years, Linda did a study of Romans and based it on using his as a principal commentary. And I'm beginning to wonder about Donald Barnhouse. Anyway, they contend that prior to the fall, the man and woman were actually clothed in light. Quote, it is more than probable that they were clothed in light before the fall, and when they sinned, the light went out, end quote. I reject this utterly. That isn't what the psalm is talking about. There's little difference between one's nakedness being covered by light and by fig leaves. You're still covered. By the sidebar, no extra charge for this. I understand that was a bad decision on their part. Fig leaves are notoriously prickly. Get them. That was God's idea. God, that was a God thing. Okay.
Well, I doubt it was. Knowing women, I suspect she tried several.
Just, so it's just right. Yeah. The point with that position, that idea of being clothed in light, the point of the scene is destroyed. Prior to the fall, a covering was not necessary, and the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Genesis 2:25. The man and woman were created righteous, sublimely innocent, the very opposite of how man and woman will be born after them. They knew no other way. Unabashedly walking the paths of the garden with God, who likewise was not offended by their naked state. There was nothing in their naked state to produce shame, thus nothing that required a covering, even of light. No, the point of this verse is that physically nothing had changed. Their bodies had not changed from one moment to the next. One moment they were naked and unashamed. The next, after consuming the fruit, they were naked and ashamed. What changed in that fatal instant was their nature, and hence their apprehension of their own bodies. What changed in that fatal instant was their nature, and hence their apprehension of their own bodies. After the fall, their nature was the same as ours at birth. While it is true that the fallen Adam and Eve are closer to us than they were before the fall, we must constantly restrain ourselves from interpreting this scene in the garden by our own contemporary standards. Just as the first man and woman in their created innocence knew nothing of shame, we know nothing but shame. Barnhouse wants to claim that, of course, they had to have some sort of covering before the fall. Well, no, they didn't. They were as physically naked as we would be, even before holy God. And everybody was fine with that. They knew nothing else. Verses 6 and 7 are the turning point for all that, a turning point that will change not only Adam and Eve, but all creation, all history. The verse continues, "And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings," or I believe it's the King James has girdles. That's fine translation. It's just a covering. Some commentators wondering why the man and woman now specifically cover their sexual organs rather than some other region of their body. Once again, interpret from our perspective and experience instead of theirs. For example, Leupold writes this, that the sense of shame should concentrate itself around that portion of the body which is marked by the organs of generation. No doubt has its deeper reason in this, that man instinctively feels that the very fountain and source of human life is contaminated by sin. The very act of generation is tainted by sin. That's end quote. But whether or not the man and woman have heretofore engaged in sexual relations, there has been no issue from that. So I'm not really buying what Leupold's offering there. We have no basis to conclude that they, at this point, would associate the sexual act with childbearing, unless, of course, they'd been patiently watching the animals. Others, such as Kyle and Delish, disagree with that and assign the action to a more spiritual or psychological impetus, and I'm favoring this. Kyle and Delish. "It was here that the consciousness of nakedness first suggested the need of covering. Not because the fruit had poisoned the fountain of human life, and through some inherent quality had immediately corrupted the reproductive powers of the body, nor because any physical change ensued in consequence of the fall, but because, with the destruction of the normal connection between soul and body through sin, the body ceased to be the pure abode of a spirit in fellowship with God. Now, I think that tracks. Let me read it again. With the destruction of the normal connection between soul and body through sin, the body ceased to be the pure abode of a spirit in fellowship with God. Isn't that the mistake the Corinthians made? We studied it. We heard it again this morning. There was certain members of the Corinth church that were saying, well, the body is just flesh, so it doesn't matter what goes on. I'm spirit, I'm soul, I'm a spiritual person. The body is nothing. I can just do with it whatever I want and let other people do with it whatever they want. God's word disagrees with that position. But here we see that they're pointing out the separation between soul and spirit here, before they were united. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Between soul and body, soul and flesh. Kyle and Delish continue. And in the purely natural state of the body, the consciousness was produced not merely of the distinction of the sexes, but still more of the worthlessness of the flesh. So that the man and woman stood ashamed in each other's presence and endeavored to hide the disgrace of their spiritual nakedness by covering those parts of the body through which the impurities of nature are removed. And that's where I thought, oh, wait a minute. Where did they get that? My good wife reminded me. We were talking about this the other morning. I mentioned this Kyle and Delish quote, and she said, yeah, but. Now, in general, I think the Kyle and Delish is a better approach, although I'll take issue in a moment with part of it. And At first I discounted that last line about covering the parts of the body through which the impurities of nature removed, but Linda set me straight. She's pointed out, hey, remember the passages about what the priests wear and where the latrines have to be positioned in regard to the camp? Turn please to Exodus 28. I know where Exodus is. There's a number of passages that speak to this. Exodus 28, beginning with verse 42.
You shall make for them linen undergarments.
Speaking about the priests, what the priests are wearing.
To cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs. And they shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they go into the tent of meeting or when they come near the altar to minister in the holy place. Lest they bear guilt and die. This shall be a statute forever for him and for his offspring after him.
Similarly, he states in Exodus 20, verse 26, that, quote, you shall not go up by steps to my altar so that your nakedness will not be exposed on it, end quote. Now, finally, Deuteronomy 23, the camp of the Israelites was to be kept holy since Yahweh walked there. Deuteronomy 23. Beginning with verse 12.
You shall also have a place outside the camp and go out there. And you shall have a spade among your tools. And it shall be when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and shall turn to cover up your excrement. Since Yahweh your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give you enemies over you, therefore your camp must be holy. And he must not see anything indecent among you, or he will turn away from you.
I love how practical God's word is. I mean, it's just, hey, let's talk about this. And it's right.
That's why I was curious.
When I'd go out in the desert, you have your spade, you go out, dig a hole, cover it up. With the introduction of sin into the lives of the first man and woman, their shame may have been informed by their new tortured relationship with Yahweh God. Kyle and Dulles may certainly be correct about that. Most commentators I read want to associate their making of coverings with a newfound shame between each other, between the man and woman. But I disagree. I'm not convinced that their ultimate motivation is to cover themselves from each other, but that something within them now, after eating that fruit, spiritual, psychological, an emergence of the conscience, now drove them to cover themselves before God. That is, in their sin, they were now cognizant of a change in their relationship with Him, not each other. As we see played out more tangibly in verse 8, I wonder if it might have been in their now fallen state. Now they're like us. An impetus similar to what occurs with me on a very hot and humid day in the summer, when my articles of clothing at home are, shall we say, at a minimum. It's hot, it's humid, miserable. While I am without shame in the environment of our own home, if I'm going to go into my prayer closet and commune with my God, I got to put more clothes on. I just have to. No matter how hot it is, I'm compelled to add more covering. For me, in that moment, it feels presumptuous and disrespectful to sit there in my skivvies before my God. Now, I know He'll hear my prayer, but it's just not right for me. So, as pertains to Adam and Eve, I interpret verse 7 as a preamble to verse 8, where they literally hide from God. Whatever the details of their newly realized sense of shame, what is clearly evident is that the man and woman are now changed, and not for the better.